We are the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. Well, let's just say the 6 o'clock news will never be the same again. The days of Walter Cronkite and three network channels has long passed. Well, journalism has morphed into news, opinion, and ideological rants, all passed off as unbiased, honest news. This is Malcolm Out Loud here. So your search continues for the Out Loud truth. I get it. Well, here it won't be just the news. It'll be how we discuss the news. A drive time show you can count on weekdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We call it Nozzle. World news, political talk, stories that impact your health. Honor our heroes, stories that'll inspire you. What you'll hear next is the heartbeat of the people. The hottest topics, the news stories that trend. It's time, friends, for a new stream of consciousness. It's Nozzle.
All right. What do you think about these Iraqi agents coming up with the top five on the most wanted list in the last day or so? It seems that they got this aid from the Abdul Bakr el Baghdadi. I think that's how he pronounced
his name. Baghdadi, or as I like to call him, Big Daddy.
Big Daddy, all right. Well, they nabbed his top five guys, and it's sort of amazing. But, you know, what's taken so long is one of the amazing things on these things. But what do you think about that?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, you got to admire this because it was a sting operation, right? So they get one guy. And they get his cell phone, and they find one of those text chat apps on it, and all the other guys are on the same text chat app. I mean, you know, I'm not sure which one it is, but being in the Middle East, it's probably going to be either, my guess is, Telegram or WhatsApp, because those are the two most popular chat apps out there. And so I guess they just messaged the other guys and said, come here. And they did. So, you know, and you hear now, I mean, you know, to be fair, you hear about cops pulling stings like that, right? You know, with the come on down, you want a contest, and, you know, and then they nab these guys that have been on the lam for a very long time. And it's amazing that it actually works just as well in Syria for capturing ISIS leadership as it does for anything else. You just have to admire the combination of the luck and the ingenuity to go, well, you know, it can't hurt. Let's try it.
Yeah, I heard that they just text these guys and they came strolling across the border into Iraq and they nabbed them, you know?
Yeah, instant. You know, so kudos to whoever. Well, I mean, you know, okay. Yeah. So, like, somebody had to capture the first guy. So, yeah. So that was probably a lot of work, but, you know. So basically, what does that prove? It proves that everywhere on this planet, everybody is susceptible to the ailments of social media and text messaging and all that kind of stuff. We're all dumb in the face of technology, regardless of who you are.
We just have to watch whose messages we answer. I guess that's the big lesson learned from that.
Well, you know, it's funny, right? Because in commercial space, right? So people spend inordinate amounts of time doing these training sessions for how not to get phished in companies and, you know, some of for hacking, right? And this is essentially what this was. This was a hacking job of the highest order and taking advantage of trust. And, you know, so corporations in the United States and around the world spend a lot of time doing this kind of training. And usually it's pretty dismal, you know, like a week after they do the training, then they start sending out phishing messages and like everybody fails. And then they have to call them back in and go, like, didn't we just give you this training last week? So maybe, you know, they're going to be like ISIS training camps for, you know, how not to get phished on the internet and all that kind of stuff.
That sounds good to me. Changing gears for a minute. I'm pretty tired tonight. I stayed up till 3 a.m. to watch President Trump with Melania and everybody welcoming back the three hostages from North Korea. That was quite an event, and apparently, some of these guys' English isn't the best. They had translators, and makes you wonder a little bit about these these people that we're spending all this energy on to bring back to the country, and all this, you know, what would you call goodwill, and what they would call political capital. And already today, there's you know, things on the media saying that this was, you know, set up like a Hollywood photo op, and criticizing them bringing him in at 2 a.m. and having the president out there. And didn't seem like there were a lot of other people there to watch this. You know, it wasn't that big of a sideshow as they're making it out to be. You know?
Huh. I mean, you know, oh, come on, the Washington Press Corps. Just because they can't get their beauty sleep before they get up to go do their morning shows and they look a little bit disheveled, they're going to complain. Yeah. Oh, give me a break. This was a big deal, right? I mean, you know, regardless of who these people were, they'd been captured for a very long time. This was a major gesture by the North Korean government, to not just to us, but to the entire planet, saying, you know, things have changed, right? It's a tangible move on their part, showing good faith.
You know, it's another feather in President Trump's cap, bringing these people home on such short notice and not having to fork over, you know, $157 billion to get them.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, you know, people watched it, you know, as much as people, it was big on the news. I had some friends that are, air cargo pilots, right? So they were all over the internet on Facebook going, hey, there's one of our airplanes behind there. And the guy that was piloting the airplane out in Okinawa was basically going, yeah, there we are. We're watching them refuel the thing now. It's pretty cool.
Well, you know what's really ticks the press off about this more than anything? They didn't know in advance that we were going to get them. And they didn't know in advance also that the timeline for the peace conference has been set now, and the location being in Singapore on June the 12th, is it? I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. They're left out. They really feel bad when they're left out and they don't have a scoop. And the reason nobody wants to tell them is nobody can keep their mouth shut in that group. I mean, it's not even like a sieve. A sieve you use for things you want leaked. And these guys just can't keep a secret. You know, it used to be, I guess, that they would let, you know, a few members of the press corps in on the inside, and they were sworn to secrecy. But it just doesn't matter with these people anymore. They're just, anything they can do to blow Trump out of the water, they're going to do.
Well, so, you know, when half your questions at every White House press briefing are, you know, asking how Stormy's doing, of course they're not going to talk to you. Plus, I mean, on top of everything else, clearly this whole process is going well. It's well underway. There are many countries involved. There's so much stuff going on. And the confidence that is, I'm really impressed by, is the just how well this administration, the diplomatic corps of our country, the diplomatic corps, and the leadership of all the other countries that are involved in putting this together have really just operated tight. You know, you're seeing world leadership. This is global leadership in action. And, you know, the press is there to watch and come around and be told when the world leadership actually is ready to show them stuff. And if they're not ready to show them stuff yet, you know, they got no business in it.
And, you know, I think that if the press behave themselves, instead of trying to make the news and just report the news, and we're not part of this resist movement of the left, of the Schumer and Pelosi's, and not, you know, there was a statistic that came out yesterday, 91% of all news stories about the president are all negative.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think this is... I think this should actually be a very watershed lesson moment for the American media in particular, which has slanted coverage in, you know, partially out of political sentiment, but more than that, I think they've fallen prey to blindly doing whatever it takes to get audiences to be activated and watch them, you know, without actually paying attention to what's really going on in the world. And now it's coming back to bite them. You know, they got nothing. They're not really covering world events. It's not like their world events aren't happening. They haven't been covering them. They've been narrowing down to one or two or three pony tricks to keep people tuned in. And guess what? At a certain point, real stuff happens in this world, and you go like, "Hey, where are we?" And you go, "Well, if you stop paying attention to all the stuff that you've been playing with, just to get people to turn the TV on, maybe you'd learn something."
Yeah, it's amazing that Trump has survived and got as much accomplished as he has in this, you know, 15, 16 months he's been president now. And I just wish that all this stuff with Stormy and Comey and Mueller and everything would just go away, and we could get our country really on track and really moving on a fast track to being great again, as he president would say.
Well, you know what's really cool about it is, you know, the administration hasn't needed the press for ever since the end of the election, you know, because Dick Cheney, who I saw at giving a capstone speech at the Reagan National Defense Forum right after the election, right? So they held one of those everybody gets together and talks, and he was being interviewed as part of a panel. Interestingly enough, the other guy in the panel was Leon Panetta. And he turns to the moderator, who's from I think NBC or one of the big news bureaus, and says, you know, "We have Twitter now. We don't need you anymore."
Yeah, I just saw a picture of Cheney and didn't recognize him. The guy has lost like half a person. Why don't we take a minute to introduce ourselves? I think people are wondering, where is Malcolm? So I'll let you go first.
Okay. I'm Dennis Santiago. I am a commentator on things, national policy, international strategy, global stability, and occasionally on things like finance, banking, in U.S. infrastructure and stuff like that. I'm a writer on with some of my writings appearing on America Out Loud, and occasionally will guest host some of the radio programs that are put out by the network.
And I'm Jim McKay. I am mainly working behind the scenes, sometimes as a guest here on Nozzle, other times producing and co-producing the Viewpoint this Sunday show that 10 o'clock Sunday morning, giving ourselves a little plug for that. And Malcolm, where is Malcolm is a big question. I had a call early this morning for him, of asking Dennis and I to sit in for him today. I think he's was at the airport heading off to Singapore to do something with this peace agreement. I just heard noises in the background. That's total speculation, but I'm sure he'll be back with us as soon as he can.
You know, if he's got his white tux and everything, you know, he can serve drinks.
Well, I thought he would be, you know, organizing the entertainment, at least going to these things, because Singapore is quite a fun place. I guess it makes a good decision to go there.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutLoud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
The president sounded really upbeat last night as he was welcoming home three prisoners from North Korea. Some people call them detainees. Some people call them visitors that were waylaid. But these guys were over there from anywhere from 3 years to 1 year, sentenced to 10 years of hard labor. Amazing, you know, that he could pull this off in such a short amount of time compared to all of the steps that the State Department under Clinton and under Kerry and past presidents even have gone through to get somebody out of a foreign country. What do you think is the reason for this?
he's a man of action, clearly. While the American press has ignored the fact that he has been very proactive from day one in terms of running his administration, the fact of the matter is the rest of the world knows exactly what he's been up to, and the rest of the world kind of lauds him for it. I mean, look at the calls. In China, they nicknamed him Donald the Strong. I heard from people that were working in places like Iraq and Syria. And did you know they had Trump posters up in Iraq during the election? And they're right when we did our last air raid on Syria. Do you know that there are actually Trump posters in the parts of Syria that are controlled by, I think it's the Syrian Democratic Army or something like that, one of the factions there. But yeah, people love him all over the place. The South Koreans, are out nominating him for a Nobel Peace Prize. They're just so happy that they're, this cloud is coming out from behind him. And he's been doing it using a very talented staff that he's brought in and run and used for when they were good for the administration, rotated them out when he needed different talent to make things work. Very much like an organized CEO runs a place. And
it works. It's amazing how none of that makes it onto the mainstream of this country. It's a shame. I mean, people are only seeing one side of the man. And people say, well, why does he go on Twitter? I said, well, he can't get on the network news. Nobody's going to bring him onto the Tonight Show, or God forbid that Jimmy Kimmel would host him. Kimmel roasted his wife, which was disgusting.
Oh, but, well, they should. Kimmel should actually hire Trump as a writer, because, some of the stuff that he puts out on Twitter is a hoot.
Well, I think they've laid off all the comedy writers on the nightly, late night shows, because they don't have anything else that they talk about other than Trump when they're opening up for 15 minutes of Trump bashing every night. And if it's not Trump, it's his wife, or it's one of the kids, or it's now they're going to start picking on Pompeo, next. Because
oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I got to, let me ask you about that one in terms of because they're clearly obsessed about the guy, right? So in America, we're kind of a dysfunctional family, right? So how do you really show love in a dysfunctional family is you pick on people. And if you really look at it from a psychological behavior standpoint, mm-hmm. the amount of obsession that everybody has about the guy in a dysfunctional sense is an expression of how important he is in all of their lives. Think about that one.
True. I think the only show that he can get on right now is Roseanne. And I don't think the network's going to allow that to happen.
Well, I really think all the shows should start inviting him to get on there if they hope to remain relevant in a news cycle. It's time that they got back to the business of being news bureaus.
Right. Okay. Kind of ties into the whole thing with this Iran, Korea, the dropping out of the nuclear agreement with Iran this past week. And there's a lot going on there. We hit upon it for a minute at the top of the show. But looking a little deeper, we got out of this ahead of that May 12th deadline. But what is another facts aren't hitting the news line. There's this 180-day cooling off period, which we're really not out of it until we go through this. It's my understanding. And I might be wrong, but again, there's a lot of very limited information coming out because they want everybody to think this was a good Obama deal, and now Trump has ruined it, and he's just pulled out and away. Well, my understanding, there's 180 days there for negotiations where we can make a decision to either opt in or opt out. And when Macron was here from, I'm not good at French names. Macron.
I think you can pronounce it any way you want.
The French president, they all agreed to these additional four pillars that they were requiring to be added to the agreement. And yet people are going out and saying, well, the Iranians have kept all their word on everything, except for launching ballistic missiles and testing those. They have you for the inspectors to go in, and this is typical UN nonsense. They in the this Atomic Energy Commission thing they have to give them 30 days notice that they will be coming. Then after they acknowledge that they will be coming, they have to give them another 24 days before they can set have a date. So you're 2 months in. Anybody can clean up the garage in 20, you know, in 2 months. So it looks like you're not doing anything. And this is what's happening. So their program always looks clean and dandy, like they're complying. But how long does it take to shut off a centrifuge? I mean,
A couple of things there, right? Yeah. So they of course they clean up the garage, right? And take the stuff out of where the inspectors are going to be, and then they put it in like these nondescript little buildings where they hide all the goodies, right? You know, except for up until Mossad comes and steals them and takes it back to Israel, which is what happened to a lot of their documentation. And, you know, so now it's in Netanyahu did his press thing a couple of weeks ago about that stuff being having been smuggled out of Iran and that we've got all the documents and that they've shared it with the United States, which, you know, kind of bolsters the case of exactly what we want to ask for, or how we want to ask for it. You really think about it. The Iranian agreement was always kind of, it was squishy, right? It had a lot of wiggle room to cheat in it. And people have taken that and used the initiative cheat as part of it. It was designed that way, and it was a bad design. So here we have Trump now.
We got short end of the stick on that whole thing. I mean, I want the money up front. I want all the sanctions lifted. And then if you're gullible enough to believe that I'm complying, fine, you know, that's, and if not, then we'll back out of the agreement, and, you know, then we can do everything we want and you have nothing to stand for, you know.
Yeah, it's agreement perfect, that you know, perfectly written by some Chicago mobster to a weakling. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, never mind. I digress with factually, but I digress. Yeah.
Yeah, I understand there's only one kind of ketchup in Kerry's house, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, so it was a bad agreement, and like all agreements. Yeah, so I, you know, as I look at foreign policy or U.S. national policy and stuff like that, I mean, it's very clear that you adjust agreements continuously, particularly difficult ones, that's part of the process of how things work. And when you make adjustments, you know, you create friction. Right. To until things get better. And so here's a friction point at an opportune time. You've got Iran in a situation where they're overextended militarily, overextended financially. They've got dissidents at home that is causing problems between the religious leadership and the government leadership and how they're going to manage all this stuff. You've noticed that they've been rather gentle on the way that they're managing it, because they probably understand that they're economically weak and they don't really want their internal population doing weird things right now, which means they're vulnerable, right? And and so here's a chance to capitalize on that vulnerability. They just lost their biggest nuclear partner, you know, who basically said, sorry, no more for you. We found better people to hang out with. So they're all alone. Under those circumstances, you can look at it two ways. These guys are in deep trouble. We don't like them. Or you can also look at it from the point of view, okay, it'll be a hard negotiation, but what is the U.S. national interest? The U.S. national interest is to bring rogue nations back into the League of Nations to be full participants in a positive manner with all other countries on Earth, right? And, you know, like you go, oh yeah, we're going to have to be rough on them because it's tough love. But we got a guy that understands how to do tough love in the White House, and he's executing on that skill. You know what? In the end, I think we're going to wind up with a much more peaceful Middle East because of what's going on right now. And to the benefit of the Iranians, you know, the Iranian people in the long run. So more power to this. This is a good process.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I shouldn't have said that probably. North Korea. We've gone from Iran, which is one hot spot, to North Korea, which has been another hot spot. And now we have the three hostages home. We have a date set for the peace conference. And my understanding is right now it's set for a single day, which, you know, I guess Trump is going to make a decision that if we're not having meaningful decisions and discussions in the first day, that he's going to leave and go home. And my understanding is leaving open whether he stays in Singapore and they continue it at this point. I hope that meaningful discussions happen from the get-go. But I like the idea that he's leaving the option. Everybody questions whether or not this Kim Jong-un is serious and would be a serious partner. But, you know, he was called over to China again in the last 10 days for, another reinforcement by the Chinese leadership that this is a serious thing. Your darn nuclear mountain collapsed and caved in on itself. And we're not going to put up with any more of this. And just so you understand, they probably the ones that did more than anybody to get the three hostages released as a good faith message to the United States, and are continuing to be kind of our ally in this process. They have, I think, they have more to lose with the trade agreements and trade and sanctions with the United States than they would sacrifice or want to think about giving up any of that relationship over North Korea.
North Korea isn't worth the relationship with the United States. I mean, you know, think of it, you know, like from the point of view of the Koreans, just Korea, they make peace. The amount of investment that will come into North Korea from both China and South Korea will accelerate the pace of development in that country. It's the biggest boon ever. I mean, you know, this is it's kind of like you declare war against the world and immediately give up and they start sending you foreign aid. It's perfect. And in this case, I'm pretty sure it's going to happen. If you look at the negotiation process that's been going on, North Korea has been having substantive meetings with China. They've been having substantive meetings with us. You know, Pompeo's like, looks like Henry Kissinger. He's jumping on jets going back and forth with those guys, right? And there's stuff going on. I think the substance is there. A one-day summit to consummate negotiations that have been ongoing coming up to that day is not an unheard of thing in international policy and international diplomacy. And I think they're hoping to have something like that, because if you get together to do an announcement together, that's kind of a happy occasion, right? If you get together and you have to talk to each other for like years on end, you know, kind of like the negotiations in Paris between Vietnam and the United States, yeah, you know, North Vietnam and the U.S. talked there for like years and years and years. You know, that means there's contention. All the signs point to there being less and less, if any, contention in terms of where everybody wants to go on this one. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it could turn out to be, you know, kind of like a great party. And then on top of that, when all is said and done, you've got, you know, China's clearly going to be the big beneficiary from this, in that a peaceful Korea opens up a peaceful Asia.
Yes, yes.
And the economic potential is just mind-boggling.
And China's outlook on things right now is they have a long-term plan for domination, not only in the Far East, but they're highly invested now in both Africa and South America, in both buying property, minerals, technology, putting money into infrastructure in both of those regions. They are looking to replace the United States as the world's dominant economic and military power. I mean, they're building aircraft carriers. They're expanding their navy to become a multi-ocean navy around the world. They're already having home ports in South America and home porting vessels in on the African coast. So I think China is a much bigger threat to the United States in many ways, and also they're a huge partner. So it's a kind of a dichotomy of which way this is going to wind up. Do the communist people running the country continue this hard line militarily, or do they eventually get be replaced by the kind of nouveau capitalism you have there? You know, even though industries are owned by Chinese individuals and partnered with the government and partnered with international firms, the entrepreneurial spirit in China is very strong. Otherwise, their industry wouldn't work. It's just too fragile to be managed on a five-year economic program like the Soviets tried doing.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Jim, your career has interacted with that Chinese manufacturing machine in the past, and so the process of managing something that large is and the resources that have to be marshaled, it's army scale, and then you got the three different factions of the Chinese government. You've got the PLA on the one hand, you've got the professional politicians, and then you have the Communist Party. The biggest industries there have strong participation in terms of ownership share by those three controlling political entities in that country. I'm sure there's some rivalry that goes on between them. In the meantime, they are rapidly moving more and more into the 21st century. Look at some of the stuff that they're doing now. I mean, you know, they have that mandatory social score thing, right? Where everybody gets scored, and if you don't behave well, they will ding you, right? And if you're a bad citizen, you can't check into the better hotels. You can't fly business class. You may not be able to fly at all if you're really bad. And they've got a system that's very intrusive. I mean, I heard of a case where there was one guy that got arrested, and he was picked out of 20,000 people in a crowd by the security cameras.
Oh my God!
Facial recognition. You know, that's how pervasive Chinese control can be. I mean, this is it's Orwellian when you think about it. So here's a government that understands the tenuousness of what it's got going on, and they're staging themselves to be the dominant force first in East Asia, and given the resources, expanding beyond that, they are going to be both partner and competitor on the Pacific Rim with the United States. That's inevitable. That there's no way to stop that, and infrastructurally, their programs for infrastructure development are ahead of ours. I mean, you can see some of the, for instance, the Trump initiatives to get people in the United States to pay attention to infrastructure.
Well,
it's no idle thing. You know, if we don't pay attention to infrastructure, they're going to win.
Well, we're paying them a substantial amount of money on the debt they hold. We're paying them a $380 billion a year trade deficit in cash. So we're funding this global expansion, this little thing they have going on around the world, and paying for their military at the same time. I mean, our military budget is $700 billion a year, and people think that's extreme. And if you look at it in constant dollars, going back to the time of Kennedy, even, where the budget was military was 80% of the federal budget in 1960 and 61. Today, it's like 20%, 21% of the budget. And we are not spending any more in constant dollars in military today than we did in 1961. It's just, ridiculous. And planes have gotten a whole, you pay $100 million for an F-35 fighter when you paid about $9 million for a F-104 starfighter back in the 60s. I mean, it's a little bit different of what things cost.
Oh, yeah, but the F-35 has a better stereo.
Yeah, that's about it. The F-30, I talk to friends of mine in the military, and they say the F-35 is the modern version of the F-111. And most people don't get it because the F-101.
Yeah, I remember the F-111. It was like a little underpowered.
Underpowered, overweighted, designed by committee to do everything and did nothing well. And the F-35 is about the same thing. And the biggest criticism the pilots have about the F-35 is, this has a single engine? What happens if somebody shoots into my single engine?
Yeah. Well, I mean, 2/3 of the cost of that airplane is the avionics. And I've visited the factory where they make F-35s. I was impressed, I got to tell you, you know, in terms of what's inside that airplane and what it can do. This is not your father's F-16.
No. It's, what, $130,000 per pilot's helmet with the stuff that's in there, because they're all custom made to every pilot, which is, you know, probably more power to them.
It works. I mean, you know, this is modern air warfare is more video game than it is guts and gore. The big question in all that stuff, of course, is, you know, is if you were to get into a shooting war, it also means that we have to finish quickly, because those kinds of weapon systems only have a limited lifetime before they start to degrade, and you don't really have the factories to make more. So the people that make simpler systems start to have an advantage as wars drag on.
All right. Ah, the hour has gone by so quickly. Amazing. Couple things on a lighter note before we wrap things up here. One of the news items today was that Kennedy Center trustees have rescinded Bill Cosby's Kennedy Center Honors and Mark Twain Prize. Do you think he's going to pack it up and mail it back to them?
No.
I don't think so. I don't think that's going to happen. And along with the Kennedy Center is the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. You know, the Oscar people have booted Cosby and that prize-winning director Roman Polanski, who's been hiding out in Europe for the last 20 years, out of the Academy. Is that a surprise to you in any way?
No. I mean, look, when they booted Harvey Weinstein, clearly there's days of reckoning coming, right? Yeah, Harvey Weinstein, and then Cosby gets convicted. Polanski's been he's been like, you know, sitting there in the background for a very long time. Nobody wanted to do anything, and so they're cleaning house.
I think it's good. And one of the last big items that I have was on the news. I was watching the news on an unnamed NBC station this morning, and Mr. Al Roker, their fine weather forecaster and bon vivant for years, comes out and says the East Coast from the Carolinas to New York City is under high risk from area thunderstorms, not hurricanes, not tornadoes, but maybe 2 inches of rain. Do you think it's a slow news day by some chance?
Oh, God. Aside from Andrews Air Force Base calling people out in the middle of the night. And,
yeah.
But hey, man, you know, I like Al Roker. He makes the weather fun. If the man can work his material, you got to give him that, right? So, like, what I got to work with today? Well, you got 2 inches of rain. Anything else going on around the country?
Not much.
But. Yeah, there's no tornadoes. It's not tornado season yet. There are no hurricanes. You know, so, like, run with it. Okay, fine.
Well, the Out Loud perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutLoud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Okay, reports out of Israel had the Iranians, who have established multiple bases, some of them more permanent than others, both with ground forces and members of their Iranian elite guard manning them, to missile launching facilities and air bases in quite a few areas. And the most recent, right there on the Israeli border, and they've been firing rockets into the Golan Heights, where Israel has brought up more heavy artillery and some additional anti-missile batteries. And is this a provocation related to the canceling of the nuclear agreement, as some of the media is saying? Or is this just part of Iran's provocative standpoint in that area?
I cannot understand why the Iranians are doing what they are doing in that part of the world right now. Because quite honestly, right, so they want to establish this route for this pipeline. And their national interest is to stabilize that route as much as possible, which basically means getting everybody around there to leave them alone as they consolidate that piece of property. It's not like they want attention, you know, so it's not like al-Nusra further north up in Assad country, you know, up in northwestern Syria, where they're being forgotten and, you know, nobody really cares what happens to them anymore. So, like, you know, they'll like get themselves into firefights and stuff like that, hoping to ignite press coverage. It's not like Hamas, who, you know, down in Gaza, they're also like people just, they're so over it. I mean, you know, like the bottom line is that every country in the Middle East is just like going, no, we don't care anymore. It just stop. And, you know, so they're doing all kinds of stuff to like go after the Israelis. The Iranians, I don't get it. They would be better off behaving with their neighbors right now, because they've got enough consolidation to do. They're way overstretched. They have to come all the way across to the Neva Plain from Tehran through Iraq, through eastern Syria, which, by the way, is controlled by the United States and its allies. And if you will recall, the U.S. has been trying to ask the Saudis, the Sunnis, essentially, and the Gulf Arabs to help stabilize eastern Syria, which creates a blocking force to the Iranian deal. So, like, you know, they're going to have to behave one way or another. And they're just causing trouble. I think it is a sign of their agenda crumbling around them. And, you know, including with the Korean card going the way it's going. And it just seems disheveled to me. I don't know about you, but I kind of feel bad for the guys, because they're like doing everything wrong. And, you know, like, getting the Israelis mad at you is not a good thing, because they hit back every time.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think so much of it is related to the religious aspect of the governing state there. Iran was ruled by the Shah prior to 79, when the government came down. Yeah, he had his secret police. He was whacking people and one thing or another. But it was a garden spot in the Middle East. They were tremendously successful financially. It was a secular government. It ran like a fine-tuned machine. Yet you had the Muslim culture there, which most of the people were part of. You had Christians living in peace with the Muslims. You had international trade with the Far East, with Europe, with the United States. People traveled freely. They sent hundreds and hundreds of students to the United States for education. And, you know, when you look at it today, you say, well, what's the long game for these people? What is their intent? And I think a lot of people, as you're saying, is if they can control Syria and on their west, and they're on the east of Iraq, eventually they're looking at getting back in whatever half the way they can back into the Iraqi regime and consolidating that entire land mass. So they would go from the coast of the Mediterranean all the way to, I guess it's Pakistan
east. I think they curve down. They call it the Shia Crescent, and it curves down to around Iran and goes south into Yemen and places like that. Because what they're trying to do is they're also trying to control the access to the Gulf, and because that's their way of choking off the shipments of oil if they control both sides of the Gulf. I mean, they've had this Shia Crescent dream going for a while, and it's really a dream most fervently desired, I think, by the imams, and then the government kind of goes along with it because you've got their local fanatics that would be the Revolutionary Guard, but it's a tough one, right? I mean, there is documented activity of them trying to work in Iraq to consolidate the Shiite militias, which are commanded by Iranians within the country, to consolidate the roadways along the east-west axis of Iraq, so that they're friendly to them, which is causing, I believe, some problems because most of those roadways are occupied by peopled by villages that are predominantly Sunni. Because that's the southern part of Iraq is more related religiously to their cousins across the Gulf, and so it's been. I mean, that's a lot of territory for a country that doesn't have a lot of money to manage. You know, poor empires usually don't end well.
And it can't just be oil revenues. I mean, if you wanted to talk about oil revenues and dictatorships and how well they work out or don't work out, all you have to do is look at Venezuela. It's a different culture, a different part of the world.
Yeah, but it's also very badly. I mean, you're right. It's a disaster in terms of someplace with so much natural resources turning out so ugly. And I mean, it's shamefully inhumane.
And that's kind of a segue into the next thing I wanted to talk about, and that was our economy and how well it's chugging along here. And again, our president isn't getting any credit for it. The naysayers are out there from the left and trying to attack what's going on. I mean, just this week, I mean, you have the news coming out of the 3.9% unemployment. Another 170,000 new workers brought on in pretty good paying jobs. I mean, some almost 400,000 manufacturing jobs have been created in the last 14 months, which is outstanding because manufacturing jobs are good paying jobs. They're not your $3.50 or $4.50 an hour sub a minimum wage. Waiting on tables kind of thing, relying on tips type of jobs. So it's really been a big turn in the economy. The Federal Reserve came out and said that they're looking right now, because there have been no signs of really strong inflation, of not pushing the interest rates up. So there's another strong indicator that we're having full employment, we're raising manufacturing, We're doing much better all the way across the board, but we're not creating inflation because the supply is able to maintain the demand. I mean, you have inflation when demand exceeds supply and you start bidding on resources you don't have. And And manpower, even though we're at full employment, 3.9%, I think there's still people that are sitting outside of the labor force, and for one reason or another. And a lot of it could be they're waiting for their unemployment benefits to run out, or some other reasons that they've been reluctant to get back into it. You know, there's a lot of college students, I think, that are waiting for the right job opportunities right now. And with companies like Apple bringing back now $450 billion worth of their money and investing it, both, you know, they bought back a nice chunk of stock, but at the same time, they also had Warren Buffett buy 75 million shares of it. So that's, you know, going in both directions.
Our economy, that is the interesting thing about the economy getting healthy. Healthier in a non-inflationary mode. That's classic economics, balancing of supply and demand, and it's being done essentially amorphously, right? You know, like industry is picking this stuff up on its own. There's not a lot of government push one way or the other. You don't see a lot. It's not like the big programs, the big social programs of the 1960s, creating things for industry to do. There isn't even a really big defense buildup, you know, when you really look at it, you know, so which is one of the big government drivers for stuff like that. There's some catch up, but it's not overwhelming. And so it's economy that's it's kind of a laissez-faire policy almost, but it's working really well.
Yeah. I mean, another thing is that I saw on the news lines this morning is Apple was going to spend about $1 billion to build a new data center in Ireland. And because of delays over there, they've been in the approval state of that, both with Ireland, who's a member of the EU, and the EU commissioners and all about this. They want to get more taxation, more control over what's happening with data centers. Apple said, forget it. I'm going to build it back in the United States. So that's a $1 billion investment that is being, you know, an economic decision is being made to bring that back to the United States. And even though a data center, you know, it's very high technology, it doesn't employ thousands of people. It's, you know, it's bricks and mortar and machines more than anything else. And, you know, you have your technicians that maintain this stuff, but it's not, you know, 10,000 workers or anything like that. But it is a sign that companies are making decisions based on new economic paradigms in the U.S. and pulling a plug. I mean, Ireland's been a very low tax.
Yeah, it has been. Yeah, it's actually been a great outsourced destination for many, many years. And now that's very interesting that the economics are now on a pure straightforward pencil are saying that your best option to manage the expense side of your income statement is to go U.S. That hasn't happened in a very long time. I mean, these are phenomenon. It's not like the world market for location and labor isn't competitive. It's that suddenly the United States, for some reason, has much more attractive destination potential for domestic companies.
Yes, that's true. You look at what's going on in Europe today, and their economies are very unsettled with the influx of immigrants coming in from Africa, the Middle East, and everything. They have very pressing problems of how to deal with that. They have a burgeoning welfare costs. I mean, all of those states have this pretty much socialistic democracy structure.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it, right? So like when you bring in a massive influx of immigrants, and so the U.S. has really been the country that's had a lot of experience with that, because we brought in wave after wave after wave. And I don't think those countries in Europe actually studied the fact that as those waves have come in, it takes about 10 to 15, maybe 20 years for those waves to settle into the place where they go from initially a negative, kind of a draining force in the system to the point that they become a positive force to the system. And I think they may have taken on too much too quickly, and it's costing them competitiveness on the world stage.
Yeah. One other quick note on economics I picked up off the wires this morning. We have this Bitkom thing, which I don't understand at all, and I don't think we have enough time here to explain it. The German city of Thiers, which is struggling to keep up with the demand for €0 notes. They've printed a euro note that has zero value, but it's bearing the face of the most famous son of communism's creator, Karl Marx, on it. And it's selling for €3 as part of the celebration of Karl Marx's 200th birthday. Now, is that the definition of insanity, or what is, or marketing? I mean, this is a great marketing job by somebody.
I'll trade one of those for 5 bills of Groucho.
You know, baseball cards were a much better investment.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of are. I mean, you know, they're selling baseball cards because it's a zero value note. But that's very interesting. I mean, you know.
Okay, time to get your predictions. What prediction do you have from your crystal ball?
Big prediction this one, I would say the big prediction of all is that I think that one day summit is going to surprise the planet. The amount of work that's been going on there is will blow people away. I think every hawk I know will be aghast that their world has come to an end.
Okay. My personal prediction is that Stormy's wonderful attorney, Mr. Arenati, is going to come up with at least 3 more people named Michael Cohen and their financial records that he can attribute to being partners of Donald Trump's corporate entity, and find hundreds of thousands of dollars that he will attempt to link to Russian collusion. All this before he gets sued by the Trump organization for slander or libel or everything else that can happen.
Hey, you know what? I think they ought to, that's the wrong suit. What they ought to do is sue to have him disbarred because he's completely incompetent. I mean, you know, what kind of a guy uses Google to find your adversary?
Well, I think that's going to put a wrap on it today. And I have one last prediction. And that is, we'll be back again here at 6 p.m. again tomorrow with a new version of Nozzle for you. And on Sunday, we'll have our Viewpoint this Sunday show at 10 a.m. And we're out.
Nozzle off.
Nozzle off.
As they say, yeah.